We have a couple of photos from the books here from which cover this particular period of time, 1967, 1969. Both of showing you with planes all coming off on travels.
Oh, yes.
One showing you with Graham Frydenberg, obviously.
Graham Frydenberg and my little... This is when we're getting off a plane. Now, that is a... Oh, that's a TAA aircraft. Graham in his overcoat. I'm in some funny-looking coat. I think it was grey, a cotton coat with buffed-up hair and dark glasses. Whitlam used to hate us wearing dark glasses. He said, take off those dark glasses. I cannot see your eyes. And if you can't see your eyes, I can't see you. But obviously I was wearing dark glasses. I was still allowed to. We were outdoors. Carrying a handbag, a sheaf of papers, and a briefcase. And the other one is old Graham and I standing outside the Parliament offices in Martin Place, setting off somewhere. That must have been 1967, so the other one is 69. 67, yes, well, that was very, very early days. Again, one handbag and two briefcases this time. We used to carry an inordinate amount of stuff around.
What was in the briefcase?
Oh, address books, they were always about that thick. Notebooks, paper. I don't know where the typewriter is here. I don't know what else would be in there, but it would be all, and probably maybe files for particular places we were going to. They were fairly heavy, but if you had one in each hand, it was not a problem.
What sort of typewriters would you actually bring along?
My recollection is that we had Hermes typewriters in the period leading up to 72, and at some stage we transferred over to those IBM Select the Golf Ball machines, which, and we had a very unusual portable version of that. I seem to remember that. But that was as fancy as we got.
So it must be rather a lot to carry.
Oh, yes. But as I say, if you had one in each arm, you were balanced. But they were heavy. Oh, we used to carry, somebody used to carry Hansards. We always took Hansards with us. Whitlam had a habit of annotating on the top right-hand corner of each daily Hansard his questions on notice or his speeches. And so whenever on an election campaign or on a by-election campaign, we'd certainly have the great big thing of Hansards with us with all those indexes on the front. He was a great believer in the record and the Hansard record.
When you were travelling, what sort of pay arrangements were there for you? Did you get a daily allowance for hotels, or did they pay the odd bills for you?
We didn't pay our own bills, I don't think. I don't remember. I think that they must have been picked up. One of us must have signed for all the staff members, and probably the bills would have gone back to the department. There was an arrangement whereby if you were forced to stay in the same hotel as your boss, you could the Commonwealth would pay for that, the whole amount of the bill. If that wasn't necessary, if he was in Brisbane and you were in Melbourne, you could only get whatever the stipulated travel allowance for that city was at that time. But in a situation where you had to stay in a particular hotel, the Commonwealth could pick up the whole tab. So I don't remember any. We used to get travelling allowance though, but that was not during election campaigns. I think it was different during campaigns. Forgive me, I forget the details. It was obviously not a problem.
During 69-70, that sort of period of time, did you travel overseas at all for work?
No. No, the only trip I did, quote, overseas, and we didn't really call it overseas, was to New Guinea. When was that? The end of 69, the beginning of 70. And that was fascinating. I mean, I had been overseas before, so it wasn't, but I hadn't been to New Guinea before. there was the purpose of the visit really was to encourage the Papua New Guinea political leadership to think about self-government, because as Whitlam said to them, when Labor wins government, we are going to be, other people will put the words more precisely than me, but basically the idea was you have to learn to govern yourselves, because we do not want to be a colonial power. The Labor Party doesn't want to be a colonial power, so it's going to happen, self-government. So there was a lot of resistance from expatriates, Australian expatriates in New Guinea. There were some fairly nasty comments made. I think I was brought to understand racism a lot more on that trip. We were in Port Moresby. I was sitting by the pool taking notes from Mr. Whitlam, and he had an appointment with a fellow called Ebia Oluwale, who was a member of the Pangu Party. And the receptionist at this motel came down to us by the pool, and she said, "Oh, excuse me," she said to me, "there's an indigenous here to see Mr. Whitlam." And I said, "I beg your pardon," just like that. And she said, "There's an indigenous here to see Mr. Whitlam. His name is Mr. Oluwale, and he is a member of the House of Assembly." Well, I almost fell into the pool that somebody could describe an elected member of a parliament in those sort of terms. That was the other thing that happened on that trip. Was we went up to Rabaul to address the Matungan Association, which was the Tolais of New Britain, and they were a fairly feisty political grouping. And that's when you'd asked me before if I'd ever been frightened. That's the only time, and it probably had something to do with being out of Australia in a sea of absolute black faces. I was the only woman there, and I was certainly the only white. I might not have been the only woman there, but I was certainly the only white woman there. And that was interesting, because we didn't quite know how Whitlam was going to be received by them. That was very educational for me, and still sticks in my mind.
You said you were frightened.
Well, we had a whole oval full of Papua New Guineans, and we didn't know how they were going to respond to us. There had been some of their leadership had been in jail, and they wanted, presumably for political reasons, and they wanted them released. And I think they didn't understand enough of our political system to accept that Whitlam couldn't organise their release. So there was some uncertainty. I hope my memory is right on this. There was some uncertainty about how they would react to that news that he couldn't help them in releasing their leaders, getting their leaders released from prison. So there was just an element of, there's an awful lot of them. If they decide that they don't like us, it could be nasty. And we were on the oval, the Matapit Oval at Rabaul, which I think has since been covered by volcanic ash. But it just was, that's the only time I felt any physical nervousness, really.
Did you have any extra security on that occasion?
We must have had. I don't remember them. I've seen photographs since, so I don't remember seeing any. But the territory administration would have had people driving us, so presumably there would be some territory police there, PNG police there, but no, I don't remember that.
Did you sit in on any other meetings Gough Whitlam had with the Papua New Guineans in either of those meetings?
No, I didn't. There were quite a few. Kim Beazley Sr. was there, and the thing I remember most about him on that trip was him saying that what we are here to do is, or to say to the Papua New Guineans, is that the only way to learn to play the fiddle is to play the fiddle. They were basically saying you've got to, and also explaining why have a political party, because there was even, they were so undeveloped politically that there wasn't even understanding of the purpose of political parties. And I remember hearing somebody trying to explain in Pidgin why have a political party, and it was to do with, I can't talk Pidgin, but it was, you know, fellas think along same road, sort of simplistic as Pidgin always is. meetings, but I didn't sit in on any meetings, no.
So your job was preparing speeches?
I would have been preparing speeches, yes. I think I was the only staffer on that trip. Barb didn't come. So, yes, I would have done all the keyboarding and arrangements and, you know, getting him into the, you know, the car and making, that's the other thing, making sure a car's there and all those sorts of physical arrangements that somebody has to do.
Then Gough Whitlam went to China in 1971.
In 1971, yes, and I wanted to go and I couldn't. I wanted so much to go. I even offered to pay my own way, but I think the powers that be decided it would all get too complicated. If somebody like Carol was allowed to go, if there'd be a cast of thousands in a line behind her, so it was better to say no to me, which was disappointing. But that was all about, well, it was about lots of things, but wheat sales were a very important issue in our relations with China. And we got a letter of invitation from whichever the appropriate body in China was, like the People's Friendship Society or something like that, and I had the task of posting the reply to this invitation, and I've put an Australian stamp on with a sheaf of wheat on it, so they thought that was pretty clever.
Did you prepare the type up or take the dictation with the reply to the invitation as well?
I can't remember now. I probably did. If I had the task of posting it, I probably had typed it. And it would have been a fairly formal response.
And it didn't go in the diplomatic bag, obviously.
Didn't go in the diplomatic bag, no. Well, there wasn't a diplomatic bag. That's right. Now, that was another brave venture, because Whitlam did seem to be going out on a limb, but only days later, Nixon announced he was going. President Nixon.
Mm. And what did you do instead?
Oh, I think I had a holiday. I took a couple of weeks off and I went to Honolulu. Had a bit of a break, yes, that was good.
Was this because Graham Frydenberg also had gone?
He went to China, yes. So it was easy enough for me to take a bit of leave.
And on Gough Whitlam's return to Sydney, you uttered some famous words.
Well, apparently famous. It was one of those situations. You always used to put something on his hair, whether it was California poppy or Brill cream, because it was always fairly close to his hair was fairly close to his head. And at some stage during this trip to China, he ran out of whatever this product was, and he came back with freshly washed hair, and it was all sort of a bit fluffy. And I said, "Oh, Lita, that's a much better look," or something like that. And I think he decided that if that's the way people responded, he might just leave it like that and forget the product. I don't think he's used it again.
Yes, there are two versions of it. I noticed then Graham Frydenberg says, you said, "Oh, Lita, your hair does look nice," but and the other, Jenny Hawking, says, "Oh, Lita, that's a much better look."
Yes. Well, I don't remember now which of the two. It probably might have even been somewhere between the two, but it was the general idea was, that's a vast improvement.
Remember his reaction when you said?
Oh, he would have puffed up his pigeon chest a bit and been quite happy to hear it, I think.
Then we come to 1972, and
another election year.
Another election year. There is an interesting comment in the books about the you going to the Hydra Hotel with Graham Frydenberg to prepare the speeches.
Yes.
And there's a reference to you be quoted as saying that the sloping floors of that bill of that hotel made you feel as though you were falling into the valley.
It's a 1930s building, the Hydro. I hadn't never been there before. Graham and his wife and I went up there for 3 or 4 days, just to work, to get away from the phone and for Graham principally to be able to think clearly. And the front of it, obviously onto the main highway, and then there was a long corridor which went down towards the river. And it actually did, with glass windows looking down the Megalong Valley, but it actually did, the floor did actually fall away. And as I say, you had this glass window with this great valley down there. It was a bit, feelings of unease, I think. It was...
In a situation like you were there, how did Graham Friedberg, what was his work routine? Around which you obviously operated.
Well, I would have thought he would probably surface much later in the morning than I would. I don't remember the physicality of where. I remember that corridor. I don't remember the physicality of where we actually did the work. It might have been in a sort of a sitting room or something like that. But he would, as he did in Canberra, pace the room smoking all the while, up and down, at some not very rapid speed, which wasn't any challenge to my shorthand speed. I could have written it down in longhand. I probably could have typed it as he dictated it. His dictation pace was so slow, but that's the way we worked. And so then probably we'd break for lunch, and then this is when Maureen was with us, so we were being thinking of her. And then resume, if we'd started before lunch, then we'd resume in the afternoon. And then I would say that we'd, however many hours later, we would stop. And then I would have the task of typing it up. But the main thing was for Graham to get it dictated. I think he had the thoughts in his head. He wasn't really interested in looking at what he had dictated and correcting it as he went. He was trying to get the thoughts that he wanted all into my shorthand book.
Had he had briefing sessions with Gough Whitlam before you went up there?
I don't honestly know, but he would have had to. He would have talked to him certainly about what he wanted to say in the policy speech. I mean, it was all fairly structured. They'd gone systematically through separate policy issues and worked out it had to be approved by the federal party before it could. Policy generally was approved by the party, not specific policy initiatives. I mean aspects of policy, but the general policy would have been fairly clear. I don't know what went on between them, but I imagine there would have been serious sessions of talking about what should go into such a speech.
Did you attend the policy launch?
I did. That was at the Blacktown Town Hall. And we were standing in the wings, I remember. Lots of people wearing It's Time t-shirts, lots of well-known faces that we could see from where we were. A funny little old lady in the front row who, I think we'd seen her at a few political meetings through the campaign, who was obviously a very keen Whitlam fan, and she was there sort of at the dais or the stage trying to shake his hand. I don't know whether the police sat her down or what happened, but yes, it was very exciting.
What was the atmosphere like?
Oh, as I say, very exciting. There was a lot of hoopla. There'd been a lot of effort put into making it look good and making it work and make it exciting. It wasn't staged, though. I mean, the speech had been cut down. The full policy speech had been cut down for television, so that for the period of the live telecast of it, Whitlam got to say what he wanted to say. So bits fell out of the middle. No, it was very exciting, because I think we all had the feeling that this was it.
You personally, how did you feel?
Oh, I was excited. It was exciting. Yeah, I had a couple of friends there with me, and we all went out there in some sort of I suppose it was a Commonwealth car. Anyway.
The actual campaign. Tell me a bit about your involvement in that.
Well, it wouldn't have been very different. It wasn't any very different from the 1969 campaign. These sort of things followed their own sort of patterns. It was very much the same as the 69 campaign, both campaigns, I think you weren't allowed to do television broadcasts after a Wednesday night. So Thursday before the polling day seemed to be the last public meeting, and then Friday we would always have a long lunch, an end of campaign long lunch, because you couldn't do any more television or radio. I think there was a blackout of, I don't know, 2 or 3 days, I can't remember exactly, but there was certainly from Friday there was no more newscasting. So we all often had very enjoyable long lunches, but we were all pretty exhausted by then. So
what was your role any different to the other members of staff, for example Barbara Stewart?
Barbara would have been more involved in the logistics of travel. She would have she was always the one who organised flights and cars, and I was, as we know, working for Frydenberg. Barbara was more the logistics manager, I suppose, booking hotels, and she also looked after all the, this didn't apply during election campaigns, but she'd look after invitations and appointments and that sort of thing in the opposition days. So, but no, we would have all done a bit of everything, as always.
Did she also travel?
She did. During campaigns, Barbara and I would almost always be travelling, and Irina would stay, or Lorraine would stay in Canberra and look after the Canberra end of things. And probably one or two of the boys would have stayed in Canberra, or they may have alternated. Graham seemed to always travel. Senior Private Secretary was almost always travelling during campaigns.
So Barbara would have travelled with would she travel with Graham at all, or was that only you who would do that?
Usually me. There may have been occasions when I wasn't there, and she would have slipped into my shoes for a bit.
So when you come towards there, you've had your dinner on the Friday night. What happens on what? Can you recall
Saturday,
the election day?
Saturday morning. I certainly would have made sure I went to vote if I hadn't already done so.
Were you back in Canberra?
No, we were in Sydney. It's 72. We were in Sydney, and I can't remember the day itself. It would have been fairly flat. I mean, there wouldn't have been anything to do work-wise. It was mostly done. And we were all at Cabramatta at, I think it was the Sunnybrook Motel we stayed the night at. So we would have gone out to Cabramatta at some stage during the afternoon, I'd say, whether to the Whitlam House or to the motel. And then just wait for the results. And Don's party sort of thing.
What sort of expectations did you have of either the outcome of the election and also what might happen to yourself, to you?
Oh, well, the outcome of the election, I think there was a genuine expectation that we would win, because by then Mr. McMahon was being laughed at a bit, about the butt of many jokes, and Prime Ministers don't often come back from that sort of treatment. And I think in his own mind he'd sort of thought he wasn't going to make it anyway. The Liberals and business and the various people around didn't think that the Liberal Party was going to be returned to government. So there was an expectation of victory, yeah. For myself, I just thought, I don't think I knew what to expect. It was sort of another whole other life. In fact, it didn't turn out to be as enjoyable as opposition, but that's not why you're in politics, to stay in opposition.
What were your expectations or hopes for what you might be doing after the election?
I don't think I actually had any. I don't think I'd thought beyond the fact that I was working for Graham Frydenberg, and I presumed I'd still be doing the same thing in government. But as it turned out, and I don't know why this happened, a few days after the election, I was told that I was going to be the Prime Minister's personal secretary. Barbara went to become Mrs. Whitlam's personal secretary. And I was very surprised by that, because I had no inkling that that was going to happen. And I didn't ever ask why. I suppose I accepted that they thought that was a better way of doing it. So, but it could, of course, a bit of a strain between Barbara and I. I think if I were her, I would have been a bit disappointed that she hadn't got the job as personal secretary to the PM when she had been doing that sort of work for him in opposition. But anyway, it didn't turn out like that.